Today on Tell Somebody, author and professor Kristen Iverson and artist Jeff Geip talk about the Rocky Flats Cold War horse. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Tell Somebody for October 29th, 2015. www.tellsomebody.us. On Twitter, @TellSomebodyNow. Like the Facebook page, www.facebook.com/TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clymer. Referring to Wikipedia and to a timeline at the back of the book, Full Body Burden by Kristen Iverson, I read that the Manhattan Project, which led to the making of the first atomic bombs, began in 1942, and also in 1942, then-Senator Harry Truman dedicated a new Pratt & Whitney plant in Kansas City, Missouri, for production of engines for World War II military aircraft. In 1946, President Harry Truman signed the Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, into existence with the Atomic Energy Act. In 1949, the AEC commissioned the Bendix Corporation to build the non-nuclear components of nuclear bombs at the former aircraft engine plant in Kansas City. 2 years later, the Denver Post reported, "There is good news today, U.S. to build $45 million A plant near Denver." This plant would go on to produce many thousands of highly radioactive plutonium pits, or triggers, for nuclear bombs. There were major fires at this plant, Rocky Flats, in 1957 and 1969. These fires and bad practices that led to them spread radioactive and toxic contamination over the site and the region, including Denver. Government and corporate entities left the public largely uninformed and/or misinformed about the contamination. After an unprecedented FBI raid on Rocky Flats in 1989, plutonium trigger production ended. Today, officials claim the site has been cleaned up and the area is safe. Many people, with considerable evidence, dispute that. Today, virtually all visible signs of the plutonium processing facility are gone, and newcomers to the area might well have no idea that it was ever there. An artist whose father worked at Rocky Flats for 20 years thought that there should be some kind of visible memorial to mark the history of the facility and to serve as a tribute to the workers there. He came up with the idea of a large statue of a horse wearing a hazmat suit. The statue was dedicated just days ago, October 18, 2015, after being installed in August, then toppled and beat with a sledgehammer, removed, repaired, and reinstalled. We'll talk to the artist in the second half of the show, but first we'll hear from Kristen Iverson, author of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. Iverson grew up near Rocky Flats in Arvada, Colorado. She is a professor at the University of Cincinnati in the Department of English and Comparative Literature, where she will be introducing a new PhD program in literary nonfiction. She is working on her next book, Strange Genius, The Curious Friendship of Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla. Her website is www.kristeniverson.com. And that's Iverson ending in S-E-N. Give a listen. Kristen Iverson, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are talking today about a statue of a horse on the edge of Rocky Flats. Now, if people don't know enough about Rocky Flats, I would urge them to read your book, Full Body Burden. But can you give us kind of a thumbnail about what this is all about?
Well, Rocky Flats was a secret nuclear weapons facility located just outside of Denver, kind of between Denver and Boulder in Colorado. And beginning in 1952, for almost 40 years, Rocky Flats secretly produced plutonium triggers or plutonium pits. The heart is essentially the heart of every nuclear weapon in the United States. More than 70,000 were produced, and each pit carries enough breathable particles of plutonium to kill every person on Earth. It's a very, very lethal substance, obviously. Plutonium has a half-life of 40,000 years, so it's very dangerous material. And I grew up right next to the plant. My sisters and brother and I, we rode our horses in the fields around the plant. We swam in the lake, in Stanley Lake, and we had no idea that there was extensive radioactive and toxic contamination in the environment, in the air, in the water, and in the soil. And then, like a lot of the kids in my neighborhood, I went to Rocky Flats. I went to work at Rocky Flats myself for a period of time. The plant was finally closed down, and there was a cleanup of sorts. Some people would call it a cover-up rather than a cleanup. And the site remains very controversial to the present day. It's even with the cleanup, it's a highly contaminated site, a highly controversial site. It is slated to open to the public for a public recreation as the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge. That's about 4,000 acres. 1,300 acres, in addition to that 4,000, is so profoundly contaminated that it can never open to the public. As I mentioned, plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. That's a very long time. The heart of the site is slated to remain closed. The entire site, I believe, should remain closed. And yet what's happening to the present day is that we are building houses on land directly adjacent to the site, and it's slated to open to the public. So that's why it continues to be a very important site historically and environmentally and in terms of public health.
And how aware do you think the public generally, particularly in the Denver area, and as they're building houses all around it, how much awareness do you think there is of all this?
Well, that's a great question, and that's exactly why it is so important that we have this statue out there, that we have some kind of memorial, some kind of notice. The way it stands right now, there are no signs. There's nothing out at the site or near the site to indicate what happened there and why the site continues to be risky, you know, to the present day. Unless people have stumbled across my book somewhere or accessed a couple of websites on the internet, there's no way for people to know what happened there, how much contamination remains, and how risky it really is. And so we see that area of Colorado, there's a lot of growth and development. It's very pro-development in terms of business development. We have people moving in from all over the country. They're not aware of the history, and it's very easy for someone to buy a house out there and not find out until after they've moved in or whatever. And they've got their kids playing in the backyard, and then they hear something or learn something and realize it may not be safe for their children to be playing in the backyard. There's no legal requirement for builders at the present time to inform people of what went on at Rocky Flats, and I think we're very eager, and I'm talking about going all the way back to the 1950s, 1960s. It's always been highly secretive, and there are a number of people who would like to see us just forget that it ever happened.
Now, we could get into all kinds of details that you tell so well in your book. We don't have time for all of that, but I don't want to go without at least mentioning an FBI raid. Can you elaborate on that for just?
Well, it's really an incredible story. This happened in 1989, June 6th, 1989. The FBI and the EPA raided the plant owned by the Department of Energy. It's been operated by various corporations over the years, Dow Chemical, Rockwell. When I worked out there, it was operated by EG&G. On June 6, 1989, I believe that's the only time in the history of our country that two government agencies have raided another. It was quite dramatic. It led to a two-year grand jury investigation. And I want to mention, actually, something about how the raid began. Of course, there were many rumors and some knowledge of how much contamination was getting into the environment, how much contamination was on-site and off-site. But it wasn't until the very brave acts of some of the workers who began to quietly talk to the press. Of course, you could get fired for talking about the kind of work that went on at Rocky Flats, but it was thanks to a couple of very brave workers who began to talk to the FBI, and that led to an investigation and a late-night airplane trip over the plant with cameras that determined that there was heat and contamination coming off-site. And I mention the workers in particular because there's one woman whom I mention in the book. Her name is Jackie Brever, and she was one of the first whistleblowers out there. And she was ostracized by other workers for the fact that she spoke about what was going on out there. And she passed away yesterday, so I was very sad to hear of that. And this is a very important figure, not just with respect to Rocky Flats, but the nuclear industry as a whole, someone who's brave enough to stand up and talk about those things. And it led to great things happening.
We are going to be talking to the sculptor of this horse there as a memorial later in the show, but there was a dedication service, and I believe I read that you spoke there and the FBI agent who led the raid. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, that was a remarkable day. It was such an incredible day. John Lipsky, the FBI agent who led the raid on Rocky Flats, he spoke. Former Representative Wes McKinley, who was the foreman of the Rocky Flats grand jury in the case that I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, and then he eventually went on to go into Colorado politics for a bit. He spoke, and that was really great. Jeff Geib, the artist, spoke. We had a couple of professors in the area speaking, and then we had a surprise visit by Randy Sullivan, who was a firefighter out at Rocky Flats for years, and he's one of the people that I profile in my book. And I knew him as a child. We grew up in the same neighborhood, and we knew each other as kids. And then we both ended up working at Rocky Flats, although we didn't know we both were working at Rocky Flats. And one of the interesting aspects of his story is that he fought the last plutonium fire at Rocky Flats, which happened in 2003. A lot of people think that the plant was closed down by then. It was not. And there was a major fire in 2003, and he fought that fire, and he was contaminated during that fire. So he spoke at the event as well. It was an incredible day.
Has he had any health ramifications directly related to that that you know of?
And not that I'm immediately aware of. He knows, of course, that that he's contaminated. And, in fact, the title of my book, Full Body Burden, refers to the, quote-unquote, safe or allowable level of plutonium that can be held within the human body. And of course, the irony is there is no safe level. So anyone who's lived in the area or anyone who's worked at Rocky Flats, of course, is at risk for a number of cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, thyroid cancers, autoimmune disorders, that sort of thing. But Randy seems to be doing well, and I think we were talking actually about how lucky we felt compared to a lot of the kids in our neighborhood and families in our neighborhood, some of whom have had quite severe illnesses and deaths in the families that they feel are directly due to Rocky Flats.
With some of the publicity related to this horse statue, and as I said, we'll get into that more later with the artist, but travelers to Denver through the airport are aware of a horse statue out by the airport that's pretty striking. Now there's two horses in the area. In the publicity around this horse being installed, and then it was vandalized. Somebody, the artist believes, put a chain around it and pulled it down off its pedestal with a pickup truck and then took a sledgehammer to it. And he was able to repair it in time for the dedication. But with the news story surrounding these events, local TV station talked to Scott Sorovchak, if I'm pronouncing that right, Rocky Flats site manager with the Office of Legacy Management, and referring to people who have grave concerns about health impacts, such as you suggested, said, quote, well, they just simply aren't aware of the facts. And then it says he worked with the site for more than 20 years. He said the cleanup completed 10 years ago eliminated the risk to the public. He believes the Cold War horse sends a bad message. And they quote him again, well, that's what it's certainly intended to do, is to scare people. Your reaction to that? And it says site manager of the Office of Legacy Management. What is this body and what does a site manager do at this point with the plant closed for some time?
Those are all great questions. I'm going to begin briefly with the fact that you mentioned the blue horse, the blue Mustang, out at Denver International Airport. Actually, I spoke a little bit about that at the dedication ceremony, that horse is so big and powerful and represents many things that people like to associate with Colorado, freedom, the beautiful spirit, the landscape. And now we have this red horse out at the Rocky Flats site, which is, again, life-size or a little bit bigger than life-size, actually, except this horse is wearing a red hazmat suit and goggles, and it doesn't look out to the mountains. It looks into the site toward the area that is most deeply contaminated. And this horse represents some very different things. It represents caution, warning, and a kind of a different kind of boundary, a limiting sense of fear and concern. It's a very, very important symbol, and it resonates with the blue horse, but it's quite a different kind of thing. And I might add also, it's very appropriate that we have a horse for this statue out there, because it's in the animals that we began to first see some of the evidence of contamination out there in horses. Right in my neighborhood, for example, they found strontium in the bones of horses. And, of course, I spent my childhood riding bareback around that plant, and the horse is a very powerful symbol.
The voice you've been hearing is that of author and professor Kristen Iverson. We'll be back with more about Rocky Flats and the Cold War horse with Iverson and with artist Jeff Geip after you listen to this. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clamer. Let's get back to my conversation with author Kristen Iverson responding to government and corporate claims about the supposed cleanup of the former plutonium plant at Rocky Flats near Denver, Colorado.
With respect to what the site manager is saying and what actually is at the site, some of the well, let me begin by saying that there's a history of misinformation or only partial information or straight-out denial coming from government and corporate officials with respect to Rocky Flats. And in the publicity that has been happening very recently, some officials have been saying that there has never been any proof of any kind of health effects or incidents or concerns for people who live around Rocky Flats. Now, the workers, that's another big subject, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into that with what's happened with the workers, but that's just simply not true. We have studies going all the way back to the 1960s and 1970s that show evidence of cancer and other effects in the area. Local veterinarians report a higher incidence of cancer in dogs. In particular, we have a dog park out there now, and pet owners are finding a higher rate of cancer in the paws of dogs, which is interesting. But I'm most concerned about local residents and children and some of the more vulnerable populations in the area. And some of the studies I think that are most useful to look at, there was one by Richard Clapp at Boston University that's very important. I also want to mention Dr. Carl Johnson. He was director of Jefferson County Health Department in the 1980s. And he initiated a number of studies. He didn't do the studies himself. He, initiated them. They were done with various government agencies and universities. And they showed a higher incidence of cancer in local residents. Based on that, the reason why he initiated these studies is that developers were coming to him and they wanted to develop that land. And he said, we're not going to build houses on that land until we can prove that the land is safe. So he initiated all of these studies. The studies showed that the land was not safe. Dr. Johnson said he would not approve any home building within 10 miles of the plant. And if it was up to him, he'd have it within 30 miles of the plant, no development, because the area was not safe. He was forced to resign from his position, although he later won a whistleblower lawsuit against the state of Colorado. Now, that's a part of the story that people don't really talk about. That's part of the history of Rocky Flats that some people would like to forget. But there is a long-standing history of studies that have shown things that are happening in the area. Since my book came out, I have received hundreds of emails of people who are sick or they have had illnesses or deaths in their families. And I think this just points to, number one, we need more studies. We need public health monitoring out there for people who live in the area and have concerns. None of this has been available. What we get from local officials is just this constant mantra of it's safe, don't worry about it, don't think about it. You know, and my own feeling is that, you know, people have the right to make up their own mind, of course, but they should be given the opportunity to learn some of the facts and some of the history and story of the plant that's being hidden from them. And that's why this horse is just so important. At the very minimum, it will allow people to stop and think and wonder, well, I wonder what happened here. Maybe I need to know this.
What is this organization that this guy is site manager of? This is some government body, and do you know anything more about that?
Yeah, Scott Surchuk, he is the site manager. The site is managed by the Department of Energy. As I mentioned earlier, 4,000 acres were transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So he's primarily talking about the 1,300 acres that are permanently closed. And then the position of the Department of Energy is that the rest of the site is safe enough. It's not safe, but they're saying that levels of contamination are, to their mind, you know, it's low enough to allow people to come on site. There are other studies that show that that may not be the case, and there was off-site independent testing done down Indiana Avenue, which is directly adjacent to the site, and some of your listeners may know where that is. And plutonium contamination was found at a couple of sites on Indiana Avenue. So there is a body of evidence to suggest that at the very minimum there's some risk involved, and maybe a lot of risk involved. People deserve to know that, and I'm not sure why the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Department of Energy continues to insist a sort of blanket statement that everything is safe. Anyone who goes to the internet and looks at the minutes and information from the Rocky Flat Stewardship Council, you can see where contamination is being measured coming off the site in particular areas and traveling into local residential neighborhoods. And this is of concern, and, you know, out at that site, there's a lot of wind, obviously. So high wind comes down off those mountains and sweeps across the site. There's a lot of rain and snow. We had floods. The entire site was flooded 2 years ago, and there was a lot of concern about contamination in the water. And plutonium attaches. There was a lot of concern about sediment transfer, about plutonium and other contaminants perhaps attaching to some of the soil that was coming off during that flooding. And then when the waters evaporate, of course, that material is resuspended in the air. So there are real ongoing concerns, and we're not getting the full truth from our government officials.
Well, and not to go too far afield here, but I can't resist getting into it a little bit. You may be aware that Kansas City has a nuclear weapons plant. There was one in operation from near the beginning of the industrialization of nuclear weapons production that recently closed, and we've built the NNSA has built a brand new one still within Kansas City limits. But the old plant did not deal with massive amounts of plutonium like Rocky Flats. It was supposedly all non-nuclear, although I think there were incidents of traces of radioactive materials found perhaps from shipping parts back and forth for disassembly and whatnot. And they did, I believe, machine depleted uranium and did a lot of work with beryllium, plus all kinds of solvents and contaminants that any large industrial facility would do, and a lot of sick workers. And they're talking about cleaning up the old site and, making it available for redevelopment. And there doesn't seem to be much public awareness or concern about it. There have been news reports from citing government and other estimates suggesting it would cost $1 billion to clean this place up. Private developer is now saying that it can, I forget the figure, but do it for a fraction of that, and all kinds of happy talk about don't worry. Given, I think I know the answer to this question or have some sense of it, but what would you say to Kansas City residents? Any advice on should they be concerned, and how much should they trust the DOE and the private developers and the NNSA telling them not to worry about anything?
Well, I think this is a huge issue. We see this happening at Rocky Flats and in Kansas City and at other sites as well. This push to turn part of the area into a wildlife refuge, and you really have to put quotation marks around the term wildlife refuge, because one thing it does is that it allows a site to continue to hold varying levels, often high levels, of contamination. Long-term materials like plutonium, and then also the effects of shorter-term things like carbon tetrachloride. We had a lot of carbon tetrachloride in our neighborhood, that sort of thing. And it's allowed to remain. These sites are so deeply contaminated that, the government looks at it and says, well, it's going to be, billions of dollars to clean this up. How are we going to pay for it? We can't do it, so what are we going to do? Well, you negotiate the levels of contamination and make it into a wildlife refuge, which allows a lot of contamination to remain. And it looks pretty. It looks pristine. Rocky Flats right now, the site looks pristine. It absolutely is not pristine. And yet we forget so quickly. My children, my grandchildren already in Denver and Boulder, people have forgotten what happened at Rocky Flats, and that process will just continue unless we are mindful of it. And I think it's crucial that we are mindful of it. I think citizens need to question local officials how much contamination is going to remain on site, and what do those levels really mean? Often the levels are raised incrementally. Well, we thought this amount was safe. Now we think maybe a little more might be okay. Who is doing the measuring? What do those measurements mean? Is there off-site contamination, materials coming off the site? Is it being measured? By whom? What does it mean? By how often? How often is it being measured? You know, that sort of thing. There are many people who believe, scientists and physicists and others, who felt that the Rocky Flats site should have been turned into what might be called a national sacrifice zone. And what that means is that the area is just so deeply contaminated with long-term contaminants that the best we can do is kind of make it into a memorial and close it off. Do not allow public access, school field trips and that sort of thing onto the site. Commemorate it, historicize it, so this is what happened here, and keep it closed until maybe someday we can figure out a way to clean it up in a thorough and appropriate manner. But right now we can't. It's too expensive. When I was working at Rocky Flats, the Department of Energy felt that not only was it just incredibly expensive, but that they didn't even really have the technology, the ability to clean it up. And there's been no off-site cleanup at all. So I think it's very important for citizens to be involved in the process. It should be a democratic process involving community members and the people who are dealing with the effects of living near a contaminated site like that.
And I think it with Rocky Flats much more so than with Kansas City, with, you know, a lot of housing development going up for workers when the plant first opened years and years ago, and new housing development probably as we speak this moment, lots of carpenters and roofers working on brand new houses right this minute, with people owning houses and real estate developers and so forth have commitments and whatnot. You know, I just imagine myself as a homeowner. How much truth do I want? What's this going to do to the value of my home? What if I want to get out of here and I can't sell my home because nobody wants to buy it because of this contamination? This kind of complicates the truth-telling process, doesn't it?
Exactly. What we have is it's a catch-22 situation. I can't tell you how many times I have been in Colorado. I'm doing a reading or a lecture or something like that, talking about Rocky Flats, and someone will come up with me. This happened just a couple weeks ago. A man came up. He and his wife and their two kids. They had just bought a house out at the site, next to the site. And they had no idea that Rocky Flats was there, that any of this had happened. Now, of course, they're deeply concerned about the health of their children. His wife is kind of, she's, you know, putting a garden in the backyard. She's worried about her own health. And he said to me, you know, we don't want to live here. We don't want to raise our children here. If we had known about this, even the little smallest bit of risk, we would not have purchased a house out here. And yet, what do we do? If people know that this happened here and that this site is contaminated or potentially contaminated, we're not going to be able to sell our house. We put our life savings into the down payment. What do we do? I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. I think it's a problem that's going to happen over and over and over again. I do hope that with time, or I suspect with time, what we're going to have is another major class action lawsuit. We had, following that 1989 raid, there was a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of more than 13,000 local residents who felt that their health had been impacted by Rocky Flats and also their property values had been impacted by Rocky Flats. That class action lawsuit took 20 years to wind its way through the courts. It was very difficult to proceed. The Department of Energy was, as you might imagine, not particularly cooperative with providing information about the site. On February 14th, 2006, a jury decided in favor of the class of those 13,000 people. A couple years later, that decision was overturned on a technicality, not on the facts in the case, but on a technicality of the judge's orders to the jury. It was overturned in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. That went before, went up for consideration by the Supreme Court last year, and they declined to review it and remanded it back to a lower court. So we're looking at, again, we're looking at a very complicated legal process to kind of get that going again. And I don't know what's going to happen with that class action lawsuit. And, of course, a lot of those people have passed on and or died or moved away or whatever. But the health effects of the plant continue. And I do think that that we're going to eventually have another class action lawsuit. And there are smaller lawsuits happening already. But I think that there is a kind of a momentum building here.
We've been talking to Kristen Iverson, a professor and author of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. There are about 40 or 50 or 60 things I would like to get into, but time has flown away. Any quick final thoughts you have for our listeners before we stop?
I think I might just end by just saying how important it is to be vigilant with these kinds of things. When I was a kid, my parents, Rocky Flats was just part of our landscape. We didn't really know what went on out there, and workers couldn't talk about it. No one could talk about it. No one questioned it. And my parents used to say, surely if there was something going on, if the government, if they were putting our health in danger in any way, they would tell us. The government or the corporations that were running Rocky Flats, they would tell us. They did not. And that was one of the most difficult things for my mother in particular when I was researching the book and confirming all of this data, because they thought they were raising their four children in the perfect environment. They had no idea that there was all this present in the soil and the air and the water. So I think I would just strike a very cautionary note and say, you know, do some research and look into these things before you move into a particular area that might have this kind of risk and danger.
Well, I'm afraid we must leave it at that, at least for now. Kristen Iverson, thank you very much for talking to us today on Tell Somebody.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kristen Iverson, author of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. www.kristeniverson.com. Now let's hear from the artist behind the Cold War horse installation, Jeff Gipe, G-I-P-E. Jeff Gipe grew up near Rocky Flats, and his father worked at the plant for 20 years. An internet search yielded a website, jeffgipe.com, that had pictures of Cold War Horse and many of his other works under the gallery tab. I reached Jeff Gipe on the phone and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. Jeff Gipe, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You recently had your Cold War Horse sculpture dedicated. Now there's two notable horse sculptures in the area. What is your horse about? How did you come up with the idea of making a statue of a horse in hazmat gear?
Well, I'd always been interested in Rocky Flats issues, and actually about 5 years ago I was really interested in creating a memorial, because the site, whenever the site was shut down, there was kind of no signs that were visible afterwards, no signs to tell anyone what had gone on, no symbols to let anyone know the history and the sacrifices of all the workers that had operated that plant over the years. So I ended up eventually coming to this idea, and, you know, originally I wanted to create a sculpture that was a little bit more benign. It was more just a memorial to the workers and to the site that just honored that. But it was it would have been a very large sculpture, something I would have definitely had to have funding for. So I tried to find funding for that sculpture for multiple years, 3 or 4 years, and was kind of turned down by everyone. Couldn't find any help to actually get that going. So I decided to create a new sculpture, something that I could produce by myself, that also had the same visual impact of the previous sculpture. The previous sculpture was going to be about 20 feet tall, 40 feet long, and made out of stainless steel. So I really got interested in the idea of the horse in a hazmat suit, you know, partially because of Denver's iconography and people's love for the Broncos and the horse symbolism out here. But it also was to speak to, you know, there's been a bunch of housing developments that have been built around the plant and since the time that it was closed down. So, I was really concerned about these people that were coming into the area and had no idea. Like I said, there was no signs to let anyone know what had happened at that site. So it's just kind of stumbled on the idea, you know, kind of a crazy idea to begin with, and ended up producing what is now what's called the Cold War Horse.
For our listeners who haven't seen a picture of it, can you describe it? What is it, a little bigger than life size or approximately life size?
Yeah, it's a little larger than life size, and it's a horse in full hazmat gear with a gas mask. And you can see, the only part that you could actually see the animal is through the face mask, where you can see its eyes and its head fairly realistically detailed.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to make that?
Well, I'd worked on it close to a year originally. It was like 7 months I had worked on it in New York, and then I'd come out here and finished it up. And then since then, we haven't gotten into that yet, but it was vandalized. I ended up having to do quite a bit more work to it since I've been out here.
Yeah, I think I read you finished it in 2013, put it up in August, and a couple weeks later, somebody knocked it down. Is that about right?
Yeah, so I put it up in August, and under 2 weeks later, somebody came and wrapped a chain around it and pulled the entire foundation and the sculpture out of the ground. And then once they got it out of the ground, they continued to hit it with a sledgehammer.
Mm-hmm. And I can't even remember, did you say it's made out of fiberglass?
It's fiberglass, steel, and resin.
Uh-huh. So you had a dedication this month, quite a scramble to get it repaired and reinstalled?
Oh, yeah, it definitely was. Initially, my guess was that it was going to take a couple of months to get everything back together. But I pulled a lot of late nights and had a little bit of help from my friends, thankfully, and family, and was able to pull it together in time.
A couple of us, when we heard this story, it sort of brought to mind another memorial vandalized. I don't know if you're familiar with the Ludlow Massacre. There was a memorial statue put up by the Mine Workers Union, and it stood unmolested for I forget how long, something like 80 years, and then I think it was 2003 or so, somebody broke the heads off. It was a miner and his wife and a baby. The heads were never found. Nobody ever knew who did it or why. Do you have any sense of who might have done this and for what reason?
I don't want to say any particular names. I actually don't know a specific name as to who had done it, but I heard through the grapevine that it's likely one of the developers, a manager out there at the development that had hired someone to destroy the monument.
Yeah, we talked with Kristen Iverson a little bit about this and the fact that houses are going up all over this place and developers have a clear financial interest, but also homeowners might be a little conflicted about this. They don't want their homes to be unsellable. So while this might complicate the desire for true information to be had on this site.
Yeah, it's a really tough situation because, you know, even before housing was put out there, I had the mission of putting a memorial out on site, and it's really unfortunate that there hasn't been something that local, state, or federal governments haven't taken the initiative to put a monument out there to acknowledge the workers and the history. Rocky Flat is actually a historical landmark, and yet there's no signs that even tell you that and what has gone on. But I definitely feel for the people who, you know, have homes out there, and, you know, I'm not trying to lower their property values or harm them in any sort of way. You know, I really just wish that people knew what happened at that site and can make a clear decision on whether they want to live there or not and have the facts, you know, of the history of what had happened.
And your father worked there for what, 20 years, was it?
Yeah, he worked there from 1982 to 2002.
Has he had any health issues related to that?
Yeah, he's gotten sick, and he's still around and doing fairly well. But like many of the other workers there, he had gotten sick from the plant and his exposures there.
This is sited right next to a highway, as I've read, on the edge of Rocky Flat site. How did you work that out?
Yeah, so the horses, what would have been, it's Highway 72, so it's a little ways away from the plant site. It's not bordering it specifically, but it's very close. And, you know, as you had mentioned earlier, I built this piece a couple of years ago now, and ever since then I've been trying to find a site for it to put it out there. And I contacted every government agency around, all the local governments as far as Westminster, Boulder, Broomfield, Golden, Jefferson County, Arvada, and pretty much just got the runaround for several years and, you know, didn't really have any help. You know, I was just looking to donate the memorial and even offered to set it up and everything. So I had no luck on that end, so I ended up just resorting to going door to door. And so every time I would come back, because I'm in Brooklyn, I live in Brooklyn now, but I'm back and forth a lot. So every time that I'm back here, I would go, you know, hit up a few more places and talk to people about it and let them know what was going on, just to see if I could try to find a place. So when I found this property, I was going door to door, and I had met some really amazing people, Bruce and Janice Roberts, and he had actually worked at the plant for a little bit during the cleanup, and they were interested and, you know, felt that the site should be acknowledged as well. So it's actually on private property, but it is, it's right off the highway as well.
Mm-hmm. There was a dedication ceremony, and, you know, I wish I could take the time to get more into the details, but there was an FBI raid on the plant back in, I think it was 89, and there were several fires there. There's just a fascinating and rather terrifying history of this place. You had a dedication ceremony with some pretty interesting people. Can you tell me how the dedication came about and got pulled together and who spoke and just tell us how that went a little bit?
Yeah, so the dedication was on October 19th, which was, it's actually the week of the 10-year anniversary of the cleanup, when the cleanup was actually declared complete. So it kind of come about that idea just since it was so close to putting everything up. I'd been trying to organize something around the 10-year anniversary, and I've been in contact with some really great people, actually people I look up to and respect a great amount, including Kristen Iverson. And I was actually able to, you know, I asked them, kind of not certain whether they would be able to or want to participate, but John Lipsky, who was the FBI agent who raided the plant, he was present and speaking. And Wes McKinley, who was the foreman of the grand jury, he was there. We had a guest speaker named Randy Sullivan, and he was a fire chief out at Rocky Flats. And we also had Leroy Moore, who's a longtime activist, and also Eric Fretz, which he teaches at Regis University. And he's specifically started to teach about Rocky Flats in his classes within the past couple of years after reading Kristen's book and getting more involved with the story. So, yeah, at the dedication, it was a really amazing event, and we had, I'm guessing, 150 to 175 people that turned out. It was a really amazing and informative event, for sure.
Sounds like it. And again, I would invite listeners, if they haven't, to read Kristen Iverson's book or do some internet searches. But you had
also John and Wes McKinley. They had worked on a book as well. It's called The Rocky Flats Ambush Grand Jury, and that also has a lot of really insightful information.
Give their names and the book title once again.
It's called The Rocky Flats Ambushed Grand Jury. And the contributors were John Lipsky and Wes McKinley. John Lipsky was the FBI agent who raided the plant, and Wes McKinley, he was the foreman of the grand jury that investigated the environmental crimes out there.
Yeah, I was really impressed that you had the foreman of the grand jury speaking and the leader of the FBI raid. For details on that, we might have to go to one of those books, but for listeners who know nothing about it, say something about this grand jury. The people on the grand jury were pretty upset that they were kind of muffled, right?
Yeah, so the grand jury was convened right after the plant closed down officially. And the grand jury was supposed to look into environmental crimes, and they were investigating to see if any individuals should be held accountable for these environmental crimes. Ultimately, the contractor pled guilty to environmental crimes but refused to indict any individuals. So the grand jury was fairly upset because they thought that it was their job to investigate this fully, and many of them felt that individuals should be charged. And not only were they not charged, but everybody on the grand jury was actually silenced, and the information that they had heard, all of the information that they had learned, was now classified information, so they weren't allowed to speak about it anymore.
And they wanted to tell the world, more or less, didn't they?
Yeah, and there were leaks through the media of the grand jury saying, hey, this isn't right. We're supposed to act in our best interest. So there was a little bit that was leaked. I think 12 or 13 of the members came together and released this information against orders, against court orders.
Wow. That's quite a story. We've been talking to Jeff Geip, the artist who made the Cold War horse that is on private land by the highway near the former Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. Jeff, any final words for our listeners before we let you go, and any websites or anything like that you'd like to let us know about?
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate what you said, for people to pick up Kristen's book or John and Wes's book. Kristen's book is Full Body Burden, and John and Wes's is Rocky Flats Ambush Grand Jury. And those are great sources. There's many, many, many sources, but I think it'll really open your eyes if you look into that. And a great website to check out is Nuclear Guardianship, Rocky Flats Nuclear Guardianship.org. And on that site, there's a bunch of information about the history and ongoing concerns and links to books and just a plethora of information that's on there.
Okay, and if you put Jeff Geip and or Kristen Iverson or Cold War Horse in a search engine, pretty easy to pull up some pictures of it if you want to get a look at what it looks like. Jeff Geip, I'd like to thank you for talking to us today on Tell Somebody.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.